Your check, your cooperative. As a farmer-owned lender, Farm Credit Mid-America shares the success of the cooperative with our customers, which is why we've returned more than $1.25 billion back to our customer owners over the last 8 years. It's proof being a part of our cooperative pays. Patronage is an annual decision made by the board of directors to return earnings to eligible customers. To learn more about patronage and eligibility, visit fcma.com/patronage.
Welcome to Next on the Tee with Chris Mascaro, the show where you get the inside access to the best minds in the game. Each week, Chris has the privilege of chatting with top instructors, legendary players, course architects, and industry insiders. If you're looking to improve your game, gain a new perspective, or just hear some incredible golf stories, you are indeed in the right place.
You see, Chris, let me tell you something, I haven't spoken to a press man in my life that is knowledgeable, seriously, as you are. Never.
You do such a great job. It kind of makes me feel good all of a sudden.
You do so much for the game. You're so kind to all of us that are out there in the game. You know, we need more people like you in the game of golf.
Thank you for pressing play. Now, grab your clubs, step up to the tee, and let's get started. This is Next on the Tee.
Hi, folks, and welcome into this edition of Next on the Tee, where golf legends live and your game gets better. I'm your host, Chris Mascaro. And do I have something special in store for you on this show? Two great guys who have some fantastic stories that I know you're going to love. And I'm going to start it off with my good friend, Tucker Booth. Tucker, as you guys may remember, is a professional entertainer, a writer, a rapper, and just an all-around fantastic individual. Very smart, very talented, and his writing style is just so gripping. He has co-authored and collaborated on a couple of powerful books, like Troublemaker, a memoir of sexism, retaliation, and the fight they didn't see coming with Lisa Cromwell, plus the recently released The Final Broadcast with our mutual great friend Mike Whalen. That book has already sold over 600 copies in just the first few days, and it's already receiving 5-star reviews out there on Amazon. Tucker and I dive into the inspiration behind that book, the emotional process of writing such a personal story that in many ways reflects Michael Whalen's life, and you're going to get some insights as well for what Tucker and Mike, probably for that matter, are hoping that all of us take away when we read that book. So that book is going to knock your socks off, and so is Tucker. He'll join me here in just a moment. Following him, I'm going to be joined by Len Furman, who is making his Next on the Tee debut with me. Len, as you may know, is referred to as the sports time traveler from his podcast of the same name. He's also the author of Great Golf Tournaments Volume 1 and the 1973 Mets You Gotta Believe. Len has a wealth of great stories, plus a stat that he's working on with the PGA Tour to adopt. I think it's an interesting one, so you want to hear that. He also shares stories and insights from Jack Nicklaus's performance at the 1975 Masters, Joe Louis becoming the first African-American to play in a PGA Tour event. You're going to want to hear that story, something I had no idea about. And guess what? He made the cut. He also tells a story that's near and dear to my heart, Sam Snead's remarkable run into his 60s, and even a few surprises about the Big Three and Chichi Rodriguez. So, folks, it's going to be an episode full of creativity, history, and inspiration, from the artistry of storytelling, which you'll get from Tucker Booth, to the historical depth that Len Furman brings. I know you're going to really love what's to follow here. So I'm so glad that you decided to press play and take the journey with me. Okay, but before we get things rolling, I want to give a shout out to my friends over at the Pittsburgh Tribune Review. TribLive.com is the leading news website for Western Pennsylvania with news around the clock. Pittsburgh pro sports coverage, a high school sports network, a podcast network, which you can find Next on the Tee on. So go out and bookmark TribLive.com or download the TribLive app for free and stay up to date with all the news in Western Pennsylvania and this show. I want to welcome a new member to the Next on the Tee family, Sunday Swagger. Tired of boring golf clothes? Sunday Swagger is changing the game with premium performance apparel that delivers the look and feel of $100 polos for much, much less. Never sacrificing on style or comfort, their bold polos, shorts, and outerwear feature four-way stretch and moisture-wicking fabric that moves with you, whether you're crushing drives or crushing happy hour. With over 300 unique designs and vibrant colors, ranging from bestsellers like Jawbreaker to exclusive collaborations with Guinness, Sunday Swagger offers something for everybody. And their matching prints for couples and families with children are flying off the shelves as their most popular styles. You might even recognize Sunday Swagger designs in popular Hollywood movies and TV shows, including Happy Gilmore 2. Sunday Swagger is guaranteed to turn heads and spark conversation. Visit SundaySwagger.com and join the Sunday Club for exclusive drops and member benefits. Sunday Swagger, it's your swagger. Embrace it. Own it. And folks, this year, get ready to experience the game like you've never experienced it before at The Keep. It's the brand new Bill Bergen and Reese Jones co-designed course up at Macklemore. Nestled high atop Lookout Mountain, The Keep offers breathtaking vistas that are even more spectacular in person than they are in the pictures and the videos. With its challenging layout and awe-inspiring views, every round there is an unforgettable adventure. Whether you're taking on the signature holes or just soaking in the scenery, The Keep is where your best golf meets nature's finest backdrop. So grab your clubs and join us up at Macklemore this year. The Keep is open for preview play and it's waiting for you. But you gotta hurry now because spots and availability are filling up fast. So don't wait. Check out both courses, the Highlands and the Keep, for yourself online at themacklemore.com. And then do yourself and your buddies, or yourself and your family a solid by getting your spot reserved now. And experience distance and forgiveness all at once with the new QI35 driver from TaylorMade. QI35 is designed to give golfers more distance from more of the face while maintaining maximized forgiveness through high MOI designs. Whether you're looking for low spin and maximum workability or easy launch and plenty of adjustability, it's available in low spin, core, and max models. QI35 also has a full assortment of fairway woods and rescues to deliver distance and forgiveness throughout the top end of your bag. Check them all out online at TaylorMadeGolf.com. Okay, now back in Next on the Tee with me is my good friend Tucker Booth. Tucker is a professional entertainer, writer, rapper, and host of the podcast Rappers Don't Golf. And from an author standpoint, he has got a tremendous amount of talent. He worked with Lisa Cromwell on her book titled Troublemaker, a memoir of sexism, retaliation, and the fight they didn't see coming. He's also now worked with our mutual good friend, Michael Whalen, on a recently released book titled The Final Broadcast, which you can go out and pick up on Amazon, where it is, oh, by the way, 5-star rated. And I'm excited I get to have Tucker back with me again this week here on Next on the Tee. Hey, Tucker, how are you, my friend?
Chris, very, very happy to be back on the show. Happy to be here talking with you today and wishing you all the best with your current medical trials and tribulations, sir.
I appreciate that very much. All right, so let's get right into it because, as you know, Mike Whalen was on the show with me a few weeks ago, and we talked about the book and your relationship with him. But for the folks who haven't listened to that episode yet, remind everybody about Mike Whalen and the special relationship the two of you have.
Well, you know what? It goes back even further than initially my time with Michael Whalen. When I was writing for this website back in the day called From the Back Tees, which is now defunct, I was covering golf, but I was kind of more their profiler. And one of my early podcast interviews for them was with Peter Kessler, the former kind of Bob Costas of the Golf Channel, if you will. And that interview with Peter Kessler turned into long-term kind of battle with Peter Kessler, but part of the story that eventually unfolded and that came out involved Michael Whalen reaching out to me wanting to help me tell that story because he had this insight into Peter Kessler being his senior executive producer at Golf Channel that no one else had. And so Mike very graciously not only reached out to me but became a real inside scoop kind of guy on this Kessler story that I wrote. And that story ended up coming out, going viral, and getting me a lot of opportunity. But the biggest opportunity that came out of it was working directly with Michael after that. So after I told the Peter Kessler and Tucker Booth story, Mike said, I want you to help me tell my story. And we spent almost a year together, Chris, working on his memoir at that time. And in 2018, I believe, we put out I Built a Masterpiece and Then I Fell Apart, the Michael J. Whalen story. And that was basically telling about his childhood, coming up in a tough situation as a young man, breaking into media at HBO Sports, eventually going on to be the chief architect of the Golf Channel, and then eventually dealing with mental health struggles and cancer battle, which came back around, obviously, with this book that we just wrote. But that was one of the greatest things I've ever been a part of writing. It took a year of my life to do it with them. But when that came out, it really led to all the great opportunities with Lisa and everything else as a result, was all the direct result working with Mike on telling his story. So he and I created a really great friendship as a result. And that's carried on all the way till today. And this last year, Michael was back fighting cancer again. And he came to me kind of going through chemotherapy and said, I'm going crazy doing all this chemo. So I've started writing and I'm hoping that you can help me shape this novel that I'm trying to write, which is semi-biographical. But I think you could help me tell this story. You can help me edit this story and you can help put some more flesh on the bone. So while he was going through chemo, final broadcast together. And we're very excited that it's out now.
All right. So let's take that a step further, Tucker, because as you mentioned, this isn't a biographical account of Mike Whalen's life. It's like you mentioned, semi-biographical, because the main character, Michael Baxter, is fictional. So why did you guys decide to go that route? Is it because you've already told a lot of this story in the biographical book that you and Mike did a few years ago, or was there another reason why you just decided to go this route instead of telling more, like having a sequel, if you will, to that biography?
I think the best answer I can give is that Mike is a great storyteller, and I think he wanted to tell a greater story than just his own. I think he thinks like a filmmaker or a screenwriter thinks, and he wanted to tell an epic tale. And so not that his story isn't inspiring in and of itself, but he kind of wanted to go deeper into some themes that he wanted to explore that weren't necessarily his story. And I know off air, I was saying to you, Chris, some of what we've talked about was that, you know, he's an atheist or agnostic kind of thinker. And as he was going through this cancer battle, he really kind of hashed through the meaning of life for himself and kind of these existential issues that people deal with when they're looking down death. And I think this book gave him an opportunity to kind of use this proxy character of Michael Baxter to kind of go through a lot of that metaphysical spiritual exploration without it necessarily being his own words his own inner dialogue. And I think it also allowed he and I to kind of play, existentialist ping pong a little bit, kind of trying to tell a story that maybe could help other people struggling with their own sense of fleeting mortality and kind of finding a sense of peace, a sense of closure, a sense of figuring out how to solve the problems in their lives before they pass on.
So let's take that part. You mentioned Mike being agnostic. You're a Christian. So the two of you getting together, you mentioned ping-ponging things back and forth. How much of that went on when you were trying to tell this kind of story for others to learn and maybe gravitate to because of the experiences they've had or someone that's in their family, a loved one, is going through with their battle with cancer? How much did your Christian background and Mike's agnostic piece kind of have a yin and yang and battle it out to kind of come through and tell the story being so opposite of one another from your religious views?
Yeah, I think there was a great opportunity. And granted, this goes deeper than just writing the book. I think he and I have been having this conversation off and on for years, especially as he started dealing with some of this stage 4 cancer that he's now beaten again. But, you know, when he was really at kind of some of his lowest points, I would say to him, why can't we talk about prayer? Why can't we talk about that form of healing? And he said, I don't understand it. And so I just really lovingly tried to explain kind of how I'd been taught to deal with very trying situations like what he was dealing with. And we kind of had to start by defining terms. And I think, you know, he's not alone. I know a lot of friends and family that struggle with faith, talk about, they don't know what God is. And so a lot of it was us just trying to figure out a working definition of what God or higher power meant that we could both agree with. And I think we came to it, and it pretty much makes its way into the book, which is, I told him, you know, I'm an English major, I'm a writer. I said, Mike, I don't think God is an old man in the sky with a beard that judges us. And I think that's where a lot of people get confused. I said, I don't think God's a noun at all. I think God is a verb. I think God is life itself, and it's the life that created and sustains us, and it's the love that allows us to be so creative and so generous with our spirit and with our soul. That is God to me. And I think when we kind of got that working definition, that kind of went into how we wanted to paint this journey for Michael Baxter, is trying to find a sense of the divine for the non-believer, because Baxter, the character, is a non-believer, but also kind of finding a sense of that divinity, that sense of love of life, that sense of belonging and acceptance by the universe before he transitioned into the next life.
How much of the situations, like the scene where Michael Baxter learns that the cancer is back and it's an aggressive one and he may or may not have a year to live, how much of the interactions, like the one with the character's doctor, are very similar or maybe actually what happened to Mike in his real life?
A lot of that's very similar. I think the major difference, and I know we did we were very fastidious about putting this into the book, is that the Baxter character finds out that this cancer has come about and does not aggressively go after it as far as the medical route. Michael Whalen jumped headfirst into tackling his cancer diagnosis with chemotherapy. There were surgeries. He was willing to even do radiation treatments, which I guess he didn't have to do, thankfully, but he was willing to do that. He jumped headfirst into it and just hit the ground running. Michael Baxter goes into denial about his cancer diagnosis. And then when he finds out it's too late to do anything else, then he says, well, the hell with trying to do anything about it now. I guess I'm just going to go try and find myself on the road. So pretty different there. But I think the emotions of hearing that you have stage 4 cancer and that it's aggressive and that there may not be a light at the end of the tunnel, I do think Michael Whalen had to deal with that. And I was there, you know, being a sympathetic ear at that time. And I think a lot of what that is just kind of like a lot of people. And you know, we're on this sports podcast. When you're faced with a challenge where you really don't know if you're going to be able to succeed and you have a lot of fear and doubt surrounding it, you really got two choices. It's you either bravely keep going forward, whether you're going to survive it or not, or you quit. And with life, I don't even know how easy that is to do, but yes, you either keep fighting to stay alive or you die. And so I think that we tried our best to kind of imbibe that spirit into this story, but I think the Michael Whalen story was way more of a never give up, I'm going to fight till the very last bell rings kind of attitude versus the Michael Baxter character, who's a little more passive with it.
Tucker, there's a chapter later in the book that seems to explain the picture that we get to see on the front cover of it. The chapter is Gas, Rage, Mercy. The character runs out of gas on a long desert road and a Mercedes just happens along from out of nowhere with a full tank of gas in the back. The character had been contemplating perhaps giving up and just walking out into the desert and dying. The driver of the car says, regarding standing on the edge or perhaps ending his life, it's never as final as it seems. The road always continues even when you can't see it. Even when it feels like a loop or a dead end or a black hole, it goes on. Now we're starting to kind of, to me, getting into the existential religious kind of thought. But is that you and Mike trying to be profound and trying to convey a message to the reader? Or is it something that maybe someone said to you and Mike? Where did that chapter come from?
I will say Mike was the one that conceived of this angelic visitor, if you will. And obviously, I think a lot of these characters that pop up throughout the story are kind of virtual angels, because to those who go on to read this, you don't know if a lot of these people he meets along the way are actual people or if they're just spirit visitants. We really don't know. And we tried to keep that a little bit ambiguous. But I will say that, once again, back to my religious upbringing, I was taught from a very young age in Sunday school that angels, by definition in our church, were God's thoughts passing to man. And I think that's kind of what these visitants in the books are. They're thoughts, they're thought messengers, they're good ideas, and they're constructive ideas, and they're hopeful and optimistic messengers. And I think this Michael Baxter character needed that badly along the way in order to keep believing. And I think we all need that in our lives. We need good thoughts, good ideas to come to us, especially when we're really struggling. And I think they often come through people. So I think that chapter was kind of a combo of Michael kind of dreaming up this angelic savior kind of visitant, and then me kind of coming to him and saying, yes, these are the good ideas, and we need to keep kind of focusing on that throughout the rest of this book with the other characters he meets along the way.
When you guys were working on shaping the narrative, were there moments when you guys saw a scenario differently and perhaps challenged each other to think differently or think more deeply? And then when it was done, the net result ended up being something even better than the two of you had started out with?
Yeah, a number of those come to mind. I was kind of constantly pushing Mike as far as narrative went, to be more audacious, more daring. Badass is probably the word that comes to mind. I like badass kind of storytelling. And I think the one I'll go to without giving too much away is the end, the way that Baxter eventually has to move on. You know, at first it was a debate about whether Mike was even going to die at the end of the story. Then it was, how's he going to die? And without giving too much away, I'll just say that my real adamant vision of this was kind of basically damn the torpedoes, damn everyone, damn the hospital. I wanted Mike to just kind of forsake it all and just die in the woods like a cat. I said, that's exactly how I wanted to die. And I said, you know, because that really challenges the reader to think. Now, Michael says to me while we're writing it, there's no way it's going down like that, but I hear you and I'm thinking about it. And what ends up happening is there's a flashback sequence where he's with his father as a child, and the father talks about the cat passing on under the porch and how he kind of wishes that Michael would go the same way. Obviously, that's a pretty stark kind of flashback, but it explores that concept. And then later on, as the reader will see, when he does finally meet his end, it's nowhere near that depressing. But it surely has some of those same elements of kind of being absorbed back into the environment like I was hoping for.
Speaking of the end, because there are some pretty heavy things that happened in this story, particularly at the end, and I'm not going to give anything away, but I got lost in the story reading it. So I know you guys had to get lost in it, imagining it, writing about it. Did either of you guys get overcome by the emotion of it all as you were writing the story, particularly once you got to the end of the book?
Yeah, and like any writing process where you're trying to co-write something and you're trying to give and take, I would say the emotions weren't just happiness and sorrow. I think there was a lot of push and pull and, you know, the hard times and fighting and making up. There was a lot of that along the way. And, you know, Mike is a brother, so, you know, like any family, brothers fight and then brothers hug and make up. And there was a lot of that. There was a lot of fighting for what we believed in. I think for Mike, it was fighting for me to be fully invested mentally and emotionally in this process. Because as you know, Chris, I have 1 billion things going on in my life all at once. And I know it was hard to keep my eye on the ball because you're right. Mike was 100% emotionally, spiritually invested in this book, because this book wasn't just a book. It was a lifeline. He had to quit his job to go through all this chemotherapy treatment, and his wife Rebecca is dealing with Parkinson's. This book was not just keeping him engaged. It was the way he was going to be able to help support his family as a result. And I will say that, you know, just on a side note, he wrote a second book, Bella, which is about their little support dog that actually came out before this. Bella has now sold over 2,000 copies on Amazon, and our final broadcast has already sold over 600 since it came out. This is absolutely working and helping him have not just an outlet for his emotions and his creativity, but also it's work, and it's inspired other books that are going to be coming out along the way. But to answer your question again, yes, I think there was a lot of emotional, swells, especially as we got close to the finish line with this. But I think for me, it was mainly just realizing that this was over, and kind of almost like the character has to move on. You know, we have to move on too.
Did it have an impact on Mike and his resilience for day to day? Because as you mentioned, he's overcome cancer a couple of times, and I think it's actually more than twice, three or four times it has come back in different parts of his body. He's had to go through this. It's been terrible for him on a physical and an emotional level, and it's been going on for years. And then in the midst of that, his wife, Rebecca, as you mentioned, is going through Parkinson's. So as a caregiver, as somebody who has to watch the person that they adore being taken away from them, both physically and mentally, I mean, for the two of them and the things that they deal with on a day-to-day basis, was this cathartic? Was this something to help him with his resilience, tell this story, and then almost take the advice of what he's writing about to stay positive, to try to stay in the moment, and to try to not give up on himself and give up on Rebecca as well?
Well, to answer it in a broader context, I think one of Mike's big regrets, and I don't think I'm out of pocket saying this, was that after getting to the mountaintop as a creative type in the television world, that when he dealt with his mental issues and his challenges with bipolar disorder, and then eventually with his cancer, that it took him away from that creative world, and he never really came back after that. And that was right around 2000. And for the next 25 years, he worked, he had other jobs, but he never got back into that creative world. And as I said to you on past podcasts, and as I said to Matt Lawrence recently when I was talking to him, Michael is a genius. He's a creative genius. And for someone with that much talent, that much creativity, that much passion for this type of work, to not do it for 25 years has got to be heartbreaking for him. And I think that it's very symbolic that what got him back to being a creator was something as perilous as fighting cancer and just clawing to stay alive. And that somehow in that moment, he realized that the creativity, whether it ever got to make him famous or not, was what was keeping him going, was giving him a reason for being, was giving him life. And now, it, as I said, it's not just these two books, The Bella and The Final Broadcast. He's got like three or four more that he cranked out just because he got on a hot streak writing. And I know he's got other books that he's already teeing up in his mind that he's going to get going on as well. So I think that's the biggest, most inspiring part from my vantage point, is watching him spend 25 years kind of ruining the fact that he couldn't keep being in that creative space, and then finally finding a way back independently, but as a result of having to go through this trying experience.
And one of the other things that's great about Mike is the fact that when you follow him out there on Twitter, it seems like almost every day he's writing a short story. I mean, he's kind of chronicling what it's like for him and Rebecca every single day. And for a while there, it was not just, it's not a tweet, it's not 250 characters or whatever the number is now. It was really long stories about what that day was like, and his, to your point, genius, and the way that he communicates and how well he writes and illustrates what's going on with words. It's amazing to follow him to see how well he does that each and every day.
I agree. It's almost like he writes a mini novel every time that he gets on Twitter.
Yeah.
It's wild to watch, but also that he has taken this social media platform, which most people just use to fire off little asides or share video clips of their favorite sporting events or whatever, and he's really using it as like the writer's laboratory for him. I told him there's a whole nother book in just taking all of his tweets and compiling them,
yes,
and just putting it out as a bound volume of tweets. I said, that's another book that he definitely should just go ahead and pull the trigger on right away.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with that more. Yep. All right, so just a couple more before I let you go. all in all, what are you hoping that people take away from this book once they go out there and read it?
I hope that it kind of is a call to action for anyone who reads it to live their life as authentically and as sincerely as possible. Obviously, the Baxter character is a very flawed individual. He's burned a lot of bridges. He's not been a real good guy. And what he spends the remainder of the book doing is kind of figuring out how to make peace with all the people that he's hurt, and then really make peace with himself and forgive himself and find a way to absolve himself of a lot of his sins, if you will. And I think that's kind of what everyone is going through in our own way. You know, maybe we haven't had a life as grand as Baxter's, or maybe we haven't torched as many bridges as he has. But I know, just personally speaking, I've dealt with a lot of these things that Michael Whalen and Michael Baxter have dealt with in my own life. And I think the main thing is, I don't want to wait until a doctor's saying you've got 6 months to a year to live to feel like I've already done this kind of inner work that the Baxter character does. And also that, you know, this is a road trip story. And what really kind of sets him afire spiritually is getting back out into the world, putting himself out there, meeting all these beautiful people and these beautiful angels along the way. And we can do that every day. We can get out in the world and find ways to connect with other people, share our light, share our love, share our goodwill with others. And especially in this world as it stands today, with all the problems that we know are out there, I think that is a really great inspirational angle that we can take.
I think that is too. So what's next for you, my friend?
Well, that's a good question. Rappers Don't Golf is kind of taking a hiatus for a little while. I'm finally just about to roll out my new podcast on TikTok called Tucker Booth Needs a Job. Back again. It's been 15 years since I've put this pod on the air, but we're back with Tucker Booth Needs a Job. Be looking for that on TikTok. And as far as the writing goes, I have a couple projects that I've been in discussion about as far as working with other people on their memoirs. I don't want to give too much away because we don't have anything firmly solidified yet, but there are a couple opportunities that are crystallizing as we speak. But biggest thing is, I've written a book that I've been sitting on for a few years now. I'm still trying to figure out exactly how I want to release it, but it will be coming soon. I'm going to say within the next year, my memoir called Quick Trip will be coming out, and be looking for that. I think this is the thing I'm most proud of ever writing. And I'm just kind of taking my sweet time getting ready to put it out on my own terms.
Tucker, before I let you go, remind our listeners again, how can they stay up to date with all the great things that you're out there doing, whether they're following you online or it's on social media?
Well, I would always say, if you have any inquiries or you want to just connect with me directly, best way is by email. TuckerDaleBooth@iCloud.com is my email address. If you want to follow me on socials, I'm on Twitter X at TuckerDaleBooth, and I'm on Instagram similar, TuckerDaleBooth. Those are the best ways to get a hold of me. But yeah, please reach out. I respond to every email. I love hearing from people. And, you know, if you want to talk, whether it's for business or just because you want to connect, I love getting to know all these great people like yourself, Chris, that I've met out there in the world. So please reach out.
Tucker, you're fantastic as always, my friend. It's always a pleasure and a privilege to get you to be a part of the show. I hope you'll come back and join me again soon. Update us on all the great things that you're out there doing, how the book is doing, and all of those types of things. I really enjoy getting to spend time with you.
Thank you so much, Chris, as always, for having me, for supporting Mike Whalen and supporting all my other friends on here. Much love to you, Keith Hirschland, Matt Lawrence, all your good friends that we share in common. And much love to you, man.
I appreciate it. Right back at you, my friend. Take care. All the best to you and your family. We'll catch up soon.
All right. Thanks, Chris.
See you, Tucker.
Bye-bye.
That's the great Tucker Booth, folks. Again, TuckerDaleBooth at iCloud.com is his email address. At TuckerDaleBooth is where you can find him on social media. Look, this guy is an amazing talent. I think you heard it when he was recounting how they came up with this story and how they put it all together and then came out with something that is a very, for me, an emotional ride. From the moment I cracked the book open, look, the foreword's written by Scott Hamilton, who's a wonderful friend of Mike Whalen's. plus a friend of both Tucker and I. We've had him on shows, and you guys know what a great interview Scott is, and his journey through life, battling brain cancer since he was born. But he and Mike are great friends. He wrote a wonderful foreword, and from that point on, you go on an emotional roller coaster with this guy, again, who is very, very similar to Mike Whalen and the things that he has done. And I love the way that Tucker and Mike have brought together their kind of religious views, if you will, right? Tucker as a Christian, and then Mike as an agnostic, and how they decided to mold the character of Michael Baxter and the way that he goes through, like Tucker talked about, meeting a lot of different angels, if you will, along the path, and what he learned in the trials and the tribulations of trying to get back and redeem and all those sorts of things. It's just a fantastic book. It's a quick read. I think you're really going to enjoy it. Again, it's called The Final Broadcast. You can go out there and get it out on Amazon. Again, 5-star rated, folks. So it's not just me plugging my friend Tucker and my friend Mike Whalen and their book. Lots of people are out there getting this book. You heard Tucker talk about how they've sold 600 copies already, and it's 5-star rated. So that tells you what a great read and how well it's written and how much you're going to enjoy it. So go out there and check it out. Let me know your thoughts. You can give me a message back at CT Mascaro on Instagram or on Twitter, or go through the contact us page on nextonthetee.net. I'd love to get your feedback. And then hopefully we get the opportunity to catch up with Tucker before too long. Okay, up next is going to be Len Furman, and his stories are just going to knock your socks off. He's fantastic. Before I bring him into the show, I want to remind you about our friends over at On Point Golf and their out-of-this-world On Point Golf Ball Marker. And if you don't have one, folks, you really need to go check it out at onpointgolf.us. Get the number one ball marker in the game of golf. On Point is the only three-dimensional ball marker out there. With alignment technology and a removable coin that is approved to use according to the rules of golf. As you know, putting is all about line and pace. Mark your ball with OnPoint, engage with your three-dimensional ball marker, and have more confidence in your line, execute the putt, and you're going to lower your scores. Do what the likes of Jim Furyk, PGA professionals, and amateurs alike are doing now. They use the number one ball marker in golf and they lower their scores. You know Ken Duke and Thongchai JD. They won for the first time on the PGA Tour in 2023, and they were using an OnPoint ball marker. Get yours at onpointgolf.us and make more putts. And oh, by the way, you can also customize the removable coin for any club, event, or corporate outing. They make really great tee gifts and custom products. That's also going to help lower your score. I use OnPoint ball markers. Mine is black and gold, 3D black golf ball with a gold line down the middle to help me line up my putts. It's like having a 15th club in my bag. It's helped my game. Why wouldn't you let it help yours? Again, onpointgolf.us. See what I'm talking about. Order yours today. I also want to remind you about our wonderful friends over at Squares Golf.
So Nick here. What if there was a golf shoe embraced by hundreds of thousands of golfers, celebrated for its stability, comfort, and distance? What if this shoe earned the title of most technologically advanced golf shoe by Sports Illustrated? And what if the company behind that shoe spent the last year perfecting a brand new category of golf footwear? Well, the what if is here. Introducing the all-new Pro S2 LT by Squares, a new class all of its own, the perfect blend of lightweight comfort and stable performance. You'll notice the difference. Change your shoes, change your game. Squares.
I also want to give a special shout out to our wonderful friends over at the Pittsburgh Brewing Company. Their pumpkin ale is back, folks. It's the number one selling pumpkin beer in Western Pennsylvania and incredibly popular everywhere their beer is sold. Why? Because it's everything you love about beer disguised as everything you love about homemade pumpkin pie. Go online to pittsburghbrewing.com to check that one out. Plus, there are other great beers, including the Blockhouse Blueberry Wheat, along with my family's favorites, Iron City and Icy Light, of course. Plus, make plans to attend Oktoberfest on Saturday, September 13th and Saturday, September 27th. Tickets are on sale now at pittsburghbrewing.com. Okay, now making his next On the Tee debut with me is Len Furman. You may know Len as the Sports Time Traveler for his podcast of the same name. And if you haven't listened to it yet, you need to go check it out. Go on Spotify. You'll be able to find it there. Len has also written two great books. The first is titled Great Golf Tournaments. Plus, he's written the 1973 Mets You Gotta Believe. Both are available out there on Amazon. He's also published a college textbook, Business Creativity and Innovation Perspectives and Best Practices, that is being used by several universities. He's currently an adjunct professor at the University of North Florida in Jacksonville, which followed a 15-year run at Bank of America, where he was the SVP of Innovation and Ideation. Going back to his college days, he earned his undergraduate degree in economics and his MBA at Duke. And I couldn't be more excited that I get to spend some time with him this week here on Next on the Tee. Hey, Len, thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks so much, Chris. It's an absolute pleasure to be here. I'm looking forward to our conversation tonight.
As am I. So, Len, let's get right into it, because when we were communicating prior to the show, you were sharing with me that you've got a stat that you've presented to some folks over at the PGA Tour, and that is strokes tee to green. And we've all heard about shots gained stats. There's a million of those things. I'm not sure many of us understand what the heck the math is involved to get to those numbers. But you've done some research on fewest strokes tee to green, and you've got a lot of enthusiasm around that. Talk about what it is.
I'm very excited about this. When I was writing my book, one of the chapters is about the 1975 Masters. And after the first round of the Masters, and I was looking at the newspaper archives, this is what I do as a sports time traveler. I pretend I'm going back in time. I look at newspaper archives and I follow events as if they're happening. So I'm looking at the coverage from the first round of the Masters in 1975. And I come across a quote from Nicklaus where he says, anytime you take 36 putts and shoot a 68, you have to be pretty happy about your round. And as I did a little more thinking about that, I realized, just do the simple math. If you shot a 68 and you had 36 putts, it means you only took 32 shots from tee to green. And as I thought about that, I realized how phenomenal that is. And I started doing a little more research, what was available in the newspapers from the round. And he did, in fact, reach all four par fives at Augusta in two shots and reached all the other greens in regulation. That's the only way, well, that's one of the only ways you could actually have just 32 shots from tee to green. So this was really a phenomenal round. And if he had holed a few putts, he might have shot like something like a 62 or something. Nobody's ever shot a 62 at Augusta. So I can understand why Nicklaus, who's often very self-critical, was actually pretty happy with his round of 68 that day.
So is that a stat that you are working with the PGA Tour to establish?
Well, the more I've been thinking about this in the last few months, I realized this is a great statistic, because what do you do in golf? You hit shots and then you hit putts. And we often hear how many putts somebody took, but we never hear this reported. How many strokes did you take? How many times did you swing the golf club in trying to get it from the tee to the green? It seems to me like a very relevant statistic, and one that even the casual golf fan can really grasp. I have a lot of trouble. I'm what the PGA Tour calls a hypercore golf fan. I watch every single tournament. I'm taping them all. And I still can't wrap my head around strokes gained and really get a sense of how somebody's playing when they tell me the strokes gained statistic. But if you tell me that Jack Nicklaus only needed 32 shots to go from tee to green in a round, well, I have a huge appreciation for how few shots that is, especially when you see it compared to how many shots the other golfers took. And one of the things I started looking at was I took a look at every single one of the 15 players that have had, I think it's 15 players, have had a sub 60 round on the PGA Tour. And I looked up the data on each of their rounds. None of those ever had less than 34 shots tee to green. When Jim Furyk shot his 58, the only guy to ever shoot 58 in the PGA Tour, he had 24 putts. And so by doing the math, he had 34 shots tee to green. So this round that Nicklaus had is really something special. And so I have some contacts at the PGA Tour. I'm friendly with the official PGA Tour historian. And actually in my day job, I actually do some consulting work, a market research consulting work for the PGA Tour. So I have some contacts there. And I just published my article about proposing this new statistic, strokes from tee to green, this week. So I'm still waiting for them to give me feedback. But my friend at who's the historian. He's been trying to reach the ShotLink people for over a month now. He has not heard back from them because the ShotLink people could at least go back about 12 years to see what the record might be of shots tee to green. Because as you probably know, with ShotLink, they're tracking every single shot that every player takes on, you know, every round. And I think that's only been for like something like 12 years. So they could at least get an official statistic on who has had actually the fewest strokes from tee to green. And I really wonder if perhaps Nicholas is 32 in the first round of the 1975 Masters is going to hold up. And what? I tend to trust Nicholas when he says he had 36 putts in that round of 68.
I am so intrigued by this. I'm a huge Jack Nicklaus fan, so I can't wait to hear if he actually does hold that record.
And I'd love to talk to Jack about it because he has this incredible memory. When you hear him talk, he'll talk about thinking about a shot he took 50 years ago. I just find it mind-boggling. So I wish there was a way I could actually talk to Nicholas and say, "Hey, did you really take 36 putts? Was it really 32 shots tee to green?" He probably knows.
Len, in the book, you wrote about something that I had no idea about. You were telling me that the great Joe Louis, who I didn't even know played golf, not only did he play, he made the cut at the 1952 Tucson Open after shooting rounds of 69, 72. Tell that story.
Yeah, this is one of these, I categorized it as my never heard before stories, because no matter how much research I've done, I can't find anywhere else that this is documented. And I only came across this quite by accident. I had read a while back that Joe Louis actually had a hand in breaking the color barrier on the PGA Tour. And so in one of my virtual time travel trips, I went back to the 1952 San Diego Open in January 1952 and followed the run up to the tournament and all the brouhaha that Joe Louis had with the PGA Tour. He had been invited by the San Diego Open to play in their tournament, but the PGA said no because you're African American, and they actually had a rule at that time in the PGA Tour that African Americans could not play in PGA Tour events, and he got the rule changed, and so he had and it still took another 9 years until 1961. Before the PGA Tour allowed African Americans to become full-fledged members. But after Joe Louis's efforts in 1952, if a host club and a host tournament wanted to invite a player to play, they could play regardless of the color of their skin. So I was very interested in that. But then I decided to keep going. So I wanted to see, well, what happened next? And the next tournament, the next week in late January 1952, was the Phoenix Open. And Joe Louis was invited again to play there. Now he could play without any, you know, any restrictions, but he didn't make the qualifying. So he didn't actually get to play in the tournament. But then I kept going. And the next week, he was invited to play in the Tucson Open. And this time he was invited with an exemption that he didn't have to qualify. He didn't have to go to the Monday qualifying. So he had a spot in the tournament. And this particular tournament, the Tucson Open in 1952, had a loaded field. You had Cary Middlecoff was there, Lloyd Mangrum was there, Jimmy DeMarit was there. You had all the big names except two. Only two big names in the golf world were not there, and probably the two very biggest ones, Ben Hogan and Sam Snead. Now, Ben Hogan wasn't playing because this was a few years after his big accident where he almost lost his life, and he was very limited and how much he could play. He was down to playing only like six tournaments, literally like six tournaments a year. So he didn't make this West Coast swing in 1952 at all. And Sam Snead was actually in Florida at some type of convention where he could make more money in an appearance fee than he could if he won the Tucson Open. So that's the reason you didn't have those two guys. But you had everybody else. So it's a loaded field. And Joe Louis goes out in the first day, and he shoots a 1-under 69, and that puts him just four shots behind Cary Middlecoff and only one shot behind the 1951 leading money winner on the PGA Tour, which was Lloyd Mangrum. So Joe Louis has this incredible first day. There was a couple of other really incredible things that happened on that first day. Jimmy DeMarit came to the last hole, tied with Joe Louis. He's at one under par for the day going into the 18th hole. And he hits his first tee shot out of bounds. And then in just a mind-boggling array of events, he then hits his next four consecutive tee shots out of bounds. And he wow. shoots a 14. Jimmy DeMarit shoots a 14 on the last hole. It's one of the highest scores, single-hole scores in history of the PGA. And then on that same day, just stunning, this all happened on the same day, Frank Stranahan, if you've never heard of Frank Stranahan, he was perhaps the best amateur player in the world at that time. He was nearly as good as those other professionals, but he decided never to turn pro. He routinely played and placed very highly in majors, although he never actually won a major. He came to the 18th green, having only taken 58 strokes. He was putting for a 59, and it was only a 20-foot putt. And this is 25 years before Al Geiberger became Mr. 59. And in the Tucson newspapers, they had pictures of the putt, and it looks like the putt's like right on line going in. And it missed and slid by the hole. The reporter noted that he really went for it. He shot the ball. The putt went several feet past the hole, so he really gave it a good try. He wasn't going to leave that 59 short. And then he missed the putt coming back. So he actually shot a 61, but still, you know, unbelievable round. And I just thought it was incredible that here, 25 years before Al Geiberger, you could have had the first 59 in a PGA Tour event. So, a lot happened on that first day. Then in the second day, Joe Louis comes back with a 72. And that gives him a 141, 36-hole total. And that's good for 39th place. And that's three strokes inside the cut line. So Joe Louis, one of the greatest boxers in history, made the cut in a PGA Tour event. I was totally blown away by this. And I'm reading this in the newspaper archives. And I start doing internet research and talking to people. I can't find any other documentation. It's in the newspapers of the time. It's interesting, like nobody made a big deal about it. There'll be like a line in an article, Joe Louis made the cut. So it's a fact. You can see it in hundreds of newspapers, but I just think nobody's realized the significance of this, and it got kind of lost. It's one of these things I say, it gets lost in the pantheon of history. People knew it happened at the time, and then nobody made a big deal about it, and it just kind of goes away. But when I did a little more research, and ESPN, at the end of the century, in 1999, had a list of the 100 greatest athletes of the entire 20th century. And Joe Louis was in the top 10, because if listeners don't know, Joe Louis was the heavyweight champion of the world from 1937 to 1949. He had 25 heavyweight title defenses. That's more than anybody has ever defended the heavyweight title. So Joe Louis is, you know, by any measure, one of the greatest boxers of all time. And ESPN, you know, felt he was one of the top 10 athletes of the entire 20th century. Well, nobody else on that entire ESPN list of top 100 athletes of the 20th century that is not a golfer ever made the cut in a PGA Tour event. There's just no other parallel. No, there's nothing like this. No other prominent athlete has ever made the cut in a PGA Tour event. And this wasn't just any PGA Tour event. This wasn't like the fall season we're in right now. This was an event that had all the top players except for Snead and Hogan. And yet Joe Louis made the cut. I just think that's unbelievable and really needs to be celebrated.
I couldn't agree more with that, Len. I'm just as dumbfounded by its lack of history, because when I was doing the research, I went back and found the leaderboard, and there's no mention of Joe Louis in there. Now, to your point, it is referenced in other places, but it's not anywhere in the reporting that he did it, because he made the cut. What did he end up? Where did he end up in the tournament? What did he shoot in the other two rounds? And there's just nothing.
Well, here's part of the mystery. In the third round, there was strong winds. They said it was gusting to 40 miles an hour. Louis only shot a 78. Now, it's not as bad as it sounds, because Frank Stranahan, who had shot 61 in the first round and was the 36-hole leader, he also shot a 78. So Louis really didn't do so bad. But Louis was 16 shots off the lead going into the final round. And he got off to a bad start in the final round. And he picked up his ball and walked off the course. He never finished.
Wow, he never finished.
1952 Tucson Open. And that's probably one reason why he kind of got lost.
They got DQ'd, because
he,
right?
Because you won't see his, you won't see a score for him in the final round. Now, there are a lot of newspapers that showed the detailed score. So you can, I can show you the documentation of, here's everybody that made the cut. And, it's quite clear this happened. He was there, but he didn't finish the tournament. Another interesting thing that happened, it's pretty apparent that he never expected he was going to make the cut when he went to Tucson, because he had scheduled an appearance in downtown Tucson in a theater. A very large youth event had him lined up, and they were advertising it. And one of the things I do as a sports time traveler is I only read one day at a time so I can simulate real life. I don't look ahead. And so I'm seeing these ads in the Tucson newspapers on like the Thursday. And I'm thinking, okay, now that I know, and the Friday, and then I'm thinking, okay, now that I know he's made the cut, what's happening? Is he going to go through with this this event he has planned? Or is he going to ditch it and go to the golf course? Well, it turns out his tee time for the third round was 11:42 in the morning on a Saturday. And the event was actually scheduled for early Saturday morning. And somehow he made it. He did the event, because there are pictures in the paper the next day of him with children at the event. And the newspaper the next day also covers his round, where he shoots a 78 in the third round. So it's really an incredible day. And you really got to hand it to him. Here he's just made the cut, and he follows through with his commitment and does the right thing with the kids of Tucson.
The next story is one that is near and dear to my heart. You mentioned Sam Snead a couple of times, because we all know what a great player Sam Snead was. He shares the record now with Tiger Woods for the most PGA Tour tournament victories at 82. He won 7 majors. What people don't realize enough is what a great athlete he was. He was still out there competing to win majors into his 60s. If Tiger did that, people would be losing their minds. Snead had 3 consecutive top 10s in the PGA Championship at the ages of 60, 61, 62. And I've had the pleasure of having Dave Stockton on this show a few times, and we've discussed his battle with Sam Snead at the 74 LA Open. Remind everyone about what went down between Snead and Stockton late in the final round of that tournament.
So in the first round of that tournament, Snead shot a 73. He's well back. But then his middle 36 holes were better than anybody in the field. And he's tied for the lead going into the final round with Tom Weisskopf, John Mahaffey, and Dave Stockton. And because you got 4 guys tied, not all of them can be in the final group. They were playing threesomes that day. So the final group had Weisskopf, Mahaffey, and I think Tom Watson. And the second to last group had Johnny Miller, who was one shot back, Dave Stockton, and Sam Snead. So Snead and Stockton are playing together. Now, all the other guys besides Snead and Stockton fall back. And Snead was two behind Stockton on the 17th green, and Snead drains a 40-foot birdie putt. So he makes a birdie on 17. Now they go to the 18th tee, and Stockton's got a one-shot lead over Sam Snead. So this is the 1974 Los Angeles Open, and Snead tries some gamesmanship, and this was reported in the Los Angeles Times. He says to Dave Stockton on the tee, and I'm not going to try to repeat his Southern drawl, but he says, you know, in 1950, I made two birdies in the last two holes to beat Ben Hogan here, the Los Angeles Open. And that's the truth. 24 years earlier, in the 1950 Los Angeles Open, Snead birdied the last two holes, and he actually tied Ben Hogan with those two birdies. They went to a playoff, and Snead beat him in the playoff. That and those birdies on 17 and 18, they're some of the only golf shots that are documented in a major Hollywood picture. That 1950 Los Angeles Open was Ben Hogan's first tournament back after his near-fatal February 1949 car crash. And so Hollywood made a movie about Hogan's comeback and the tournament, the 1950 Los Angeles Open. They actually filmed it on site at Riviera, and Sam Snead played himself in the movie.
Is that right?
So you can, if you watch the movie, you'll see Snead birdieing. You'll see Snead's birdie putt and a fake birdie putt by the real Sam Snead, making a fake birdie putt to tie Ben Hogan in the 1950 Los Angeles Open. So Snead brings this up to Dave Stockton in 1974. And Stockton, to his credit, didn't get rattled by Snead. And Stockton hit a good tee shot. And then his second shot, which was still a long iron into the green there at 18 at Riviera, Stockton said it may be the best iron shot of his life. And he birdied the hole and won the tournament. Wow. And afterwards, he told reporters about what Snead had said to him. And he said, I was kind of stunned. I didn't know what to say. Should I say, gee, Sam, I'm proud of you? it really says something about Dave Stockton that he kept his composure. Snead didn't get him rattled, and Stockton went on to win the tournament. But this story continues on, as I do with the Sports Time Traveler. I'm a big Sam Snead fan too, so I wanted to see, well, Sam Snead just came in second in this tournament. What happened the next week? Well, the next week they're across the country in South Florida at the Jackie Gleason Inverary Classic, and Stockton does not play in that event. But who does play? Almost all the other big names at the time. Johnny Miller, who's in the middle of his Grinch season when he won eight tournaments, Jack Nicklaus, Tom Watson, Lee Trevino, they're all in that tournament. And at the end of 72 holes, if you add up the scores, now Snead doesn't win that tournament. He contends, but he doesn't win. But if you add up the scores from the Los Angeles Open and the very next week, the Jackie Gleason Inverary Classic, across that two-week stretch, and Miller, Nicklaus, Watson, and Trevino were in both tournaments, Sam Snead had the lowest score of anybody who played both of those tournaments. And that included all those big names. That just blew me away that here he is. He, at that time, he was 61. He was almost 62. And he outscored in a two-week stretch everybody on the PGA Tour. That's just phenomenal.
Yeah, it really is. And I've been singing Sam Snead's praises for a long time on this show. I think he's as great as he was, and everyone knows his name and all that sort of stuff. People don't realize how great he was for how long he was great. I mean, to think that he was contending and he finished third in the PGA in his 60s. Like I say, if Tiger Woods did something like that, people would lose their minds and think that, you know, that's never happened and all that kind of stuff. People don't appreciate how great Sam Snead was for the span of time he was.
I really feel he's incredibly underappreciated. I was just curious. I was looking up that third place you mentioned in the 1974 PGA Championship, and nobody else over the age of 60 has ever come in the top three in a major.
That's just
another thing. I and also coming back to Sam Snead's performance in those two tournaments. Those were the first two tournaments he played in the 1974 season. And if you go back a little bit earlier that season, that's when Johnny Miller won his three straight tournaments, the first three tournaments of the season. Johnny Miller won all three. And Johnny Miller remains the only player ever to win the first three tournaments on the PGA Tour. It's never been done before or since. But in my book, I kind of jokingly say, maybe Miller's three consecutive wins to start the season needs an asterisk because Sam Snead didn't play in any of those tournaments.
Right.
I also want to share with you, I have a personal Sam Snead story I want to share with you. 14 years later, I was playing in a celebrity golf tournament at Duke University. It's called the Duke Children's Classic. It benefited a children's hospital there. And Sam Snead was at the tournament playing as one of the celebrities. And I was at the course getting ready to play. My wife was at the hotel, and they had drivers taking people over to the golf course. And my wife, they gets in a car, and as minute after she gets in the car, they come over and tell her, "Oh, you need to get out of the car. We've got a group of five men that need to go over to the course." And it turns out it's Sam Snead and four of his buddies from West Virginia that are playing in the tournament. So my wife gets out of the car, and Sam Snead takes a look at her and says, "Oh, honey, you can get back in the car." And so they all huddle into the car with my wife. My wife rides over with Sam Snead and his buddies. And then my wife gets out of the car. She comes over to me on the driving range. And apparently Snead follows my wife. I don't know all this is happening yet, but I hit another shot on the range, and I'm having a bad morning. And I slam my club down. And there's a lot of people watching. I know I shouldn't have done this. And I bend down to pick up my club. So I'm kind of down on my knees almost picking up my club. And I hear this Southern drawl saying, "Son, pick up your club." And I look up, and I'm literally from a crouched position. I'm looking up in the sky, and I see, and I think to myself, "Oh my God, this is Sam Snead. He's going to ball me out for slamming my club down." And then he doesn't. He says, "I'm going to teach you a lesson." And he proceeds to teach me a lesson. And I mean, my mind is going crazy. I'm thinking, "My God, Sam Snead's teaching me a lesson." And he takes my arms, and he has me get into like a backswing position. And he kind of moves my arms around till he gets them exactly where he wants them to be. And he says, "Okay, now I want you to swing down. This is going to be a good shot." And I'm thinking, okay, a whole bunch of people who are watching just heard him say this. And I say to him quietly, "How do you know it's going to be a good shot?" Because I'm kind of nervous. He just said it's going to be a good shot. Now I got to do that. He said, so he gets a little annoyed. He says, "Just swing down. It's going to be a good shot." So I swing down, and I swear I had never seen myself hit a pro shot before this. I mean, this looked, I've gone to lots of golf tournaments. At that time, I'd seen lots of golf tournaments, and I used to camp out on the range because I always thought that's the best way to learn how to play is to watch the pros. And so I knew what pro shots looked like from up close. And I had never seen one that went as high and straight as this one. And that was the end of my lesson. He then took a spot in the range in front of me, and I keep hitting. And the shots are looking almost as good, but it's pretty apparent. Like, it's already starting, wherever he told me, whatever he positioned me, it's already starting to wear off. And then I hit a bad shot, one that was just slices terribly. Now, he's not watching. He's at the range. He's at the range spot right in front of me. So he's got his back to me as he's swinging. But he is able to diagnose my swing just from seeing the flight of my ball. And he says to me, he just yells to me. He doesn't even turn around. He just yells to me, "You're laying off the club." I don't even know what that meant. So I couldn't make the correction. And he said it again. I hit another bad shot. He said it again. I was like, "Oh my God, why don't I?" I'm too embarrassed to ask him. What does he mean? So it was the most surreal thing. When I walked off the range, one of the spectators comes over to me and says, and this is 37 years ago, this was in 1988. He says, "Do you realize you just got a $500 lesson?" By the way, that day I won the closest to the hole contest.
Wow.
And 3 weeks later, on a shot that looked almost as good as that first one I hit, I got my second hole in one.
Wow.
So And then after that, I kind of reverted back to my, yes. And so I've got a warm spot for Sam Snead. Later that day, he did a clinic. And here's a testimony to him being an unbelievable athlete. Now, this is 1988. He's 74. What is he? 1988. He's 74 years old. Now, 14. No, he's 76 years old. He's 76 years old in 1988. And in the clinic, he shows us one of the reasons why he can swing so smoothly. He does a straight leg, touch your toes stretch, and he touches his toes, keeping his legs straight. But then he keeps going. And keeping his legs straight, he gets his palms on the ground.
Wow.
At 76 years old. That's unbelievable. And that's one reason why he was such a great athlete. He was incredibly limber.
Len, I'm a huge Jack Nicklaus fan. Plus, being from Pittsburgh, Mr. Palmer was a hero to so many of us in Western Pennsylvania and around the world, for that matter. Gary Player is the greatest international player of all time and a wonderful guest on this show every year, going all the way back to episode number one of season number one. So the big three, those guys, they dominated the game from probably the late 50s and all the way to when Mr. Nicklaus won the Masters at 46 years of age in 1986. Now, they only got together and faced each other coming down the stretch one time. When was that?
So in the 1964 Canada Cup, it was the only time that Nicklaus, Player, and Palmer, the big three of golf, ever played together in the same group in the final round of a big tournament. The Canada Cup was one of these like postseason events where they don't have it anymore. It later became the World Cup. They stopped playing this in 2018. They had two-man teams from a number of countries. And there was, at that time, I don't know if they still did it back up to 2018, but at that time in the mid-60s, it was both a team event by country and an individual event. And so that year in 1964, there were 34 countries. And I have to put countries in quotes because one of the countries was Hawaii. They were playing the tournament in Hawaii, so they had a team from Hawaii. One of the countries also was Puerto Rico. And of course, one of the countries was also South Africa. So the American team was the dream team of Palmer and Nicklaus. They played together, and the United States blew out the rest of the world with the in the team event. But in the individual event, they went into the last day with Palmer leading at 16 under, Player in second at 13 under, Nicklaus in third at 10 under. And believe it or not, one of the two guys from Hawaii, a guy I never heard of, Ted Macalina from Hawaii, was in fourth place, one stroke behind Nicklaus. Really incredible. So they had, and also South Africa was an important anecdote here. South Africa was in second place going into the final day in the team competition. So they had to have the first and second place teams play against each other on the in the final round. And that was why Nicklaus, Palmer, and Player were in the same group, along with not Macalina, but Dennis Hutchinson, the second South African player. So you had the two Americans and the two South Africans all together in one foursome, and they were the final group. And so you had Palmer, Player, and Nicklaus playing together for an individual title in a very important event. And Nicklaus and Palmer talked about in the press that week, they talked about how highly regarded they held this event, how important they thought this was. So this was not just some mid-season or late season PGA event. It wasn't an official PGA event. It was this Canada Cup, but it was a very important event for the big three, taking it very seriously. And they all played together and they had a fascinating round. As I mentioned, Nicklaus was six shots behind Palmer going into the last round. But by the end of nine holes, it was very tight. Palmer had dropped back from 16 under to 14 under. Nicklaus was three under on the front nine. Player was even par on the front nine. And so at the end of nine holes, Palmer was in the lead by one shot over Nicklaus and Player. So now not only are they playing together, But you now are going into the back nine with the big three all within one stroke, all vying for this individual championship. And two holes later, it got even better. With after the 11th hole, the big three were tied, all tied at minus 13 with seven holes to go. And Ted Macalena from Hawaii was hanging in there. He eagled the 11th hole, and he was playing a couple of groups ahead, but he had eagled the 11th hole when he came through it, and he was now a couple of holes ahead, but he was at 11 under, so he's only two shots back. Then by the end of 15 holes, now you got three holes to go. Now Nicholas has moved ahead by one shot and over Palmer, and now Player's three back, and Macalena has actually tied Player. And then Nicholas went on to win it by two shots over Palmer and three over Player, and Ted Macalena ended up tied with Player. And what's really incredible is that this tournament was not on television.
Oh.
And it was only there weren't huge crowds. I think they said they had 20,000 attendance for the entire 4 days of the tournament. So relatively few people got to see this only time that Player, Palmer, and Nicholas were in the same group at the end of a final at the end of a major tournament. Not a major, but an important tournament when they were all in their prime.
Moving on to another story that also featured Mr. Palmer. There was an article about Chichi Rodriguez in the August 10th, 1964 edition of Sports Illustrated. It referred to him as Little Chichi. Well, following that, he went out and outdueled Mr. Palmer to win the Western Open. Talk about that story.
Yeah, so Chichi had a lot of pressure on him going into the 1964 Western Open because Sports Illustrated had just written up this very flattering feature article. You know, at that time, Chichi was a pretty good player. He never was a top-tier player, but he did win a few PGA Tour events. So he was having a pretty good year. But most listeners who know Chichi Rodriguez probably know that he was the master entertainer on the golf course. And a lot of the article was about the fact that he had all these on-course antics, and a lot of the PGA Tour players didn't like it. They were very serious on the course, and they just didn't like his antics. What I thought was really interesting about the article was they interviewed Jack Nicklaus and Arnold Palmer, and both of them gave their stamp of approval to Chichi. They said, "We need this kind of thing in golf. We have to remember, you know, we're not just golfers. We're entertaining the fans," and they approved of Chichi. So, but I still think he must have had a lot of pressure going into the tournament. But he out of the gate he played fantastic. He starting from the third hole of the front nine, he birdied five consecutive holes, and he was very upset with himself when he parred a hole because he said I knew I could birdie the ninth hole. And so when he didn't birdie the eighth hole, he was really upset because he really wanted to run a seven straight birdies. And he did, in fact, birdie the ninth hole, and he went out in 30. So he's off to an incredible start, and he shoots a 64 for the first round, and that puts him in a tie with Billy Casper. You've got big names at this tournament because the Western Open at that time in the early 60s, some people still considered the Western Open to be a major. If you go back another 20 or 30 years, a lot of people considered the Western Open to be a major before you had the four majors becoming, you know, kind of official. You know, the Masters only got started in 1934, so it kind of took a little while before it was actually recognized as what we consider it today, a major. So the Western Open was a pretty important event back then. Palmer was the defending champion. He had won the 1963 Western Open. So you had a really good field that Chichi is playing against. And after three rounds, Chichi is in the lead by one shot over Arnie. And you've got Casper four shots back, and Nicholas is lurking seven shots back because, as you know, Nicholas is like never out of a tournament when he's seven, even though he's seven shots back. But on this day, Nicholas did make a little run on the front nine, but never got close. It was really just Arnie and Chichi with nine holes to play. And Arnie has the better front nine. And so with eight holes to go after 11 holes, after 11 holes, after 10 holes, when they get to the 11th hole, Palmer leads by one. And then Chi-Chi on the par 3 11th hole, he hits his tee shot to 2.5 feet from the hole, and he makes the birdie, and he ties Palmer. I should say that Chi-Chi is actually playing in the group in front of Palmer. So Palmer's in the last group, Chi-Chi's in the second to last group. So on the 12th hole, Chi-Chi's approach shot is just 12 feet from the hole. It gets another birdie. But now Palmer also coming up behind him also birdies the 12th. So now with 6 holes to go, they're still tied. On the 13th hole, Chi-Chi gets his third straight birdie. And now he finally takes a one-shot lead. He's got one shot lead with 5 holes to go. Let's see. They both birdied the 15th hole. And that was Chi-Chi's fourth birdie in 5 holes. So he's really coming in here under pressure. So he holds his one-shot lead now after the 15th. 3 holes to go. He holds his one-shot lead after the 16th. On the 17th, Chi-Chi pars the hole. Arnie coming up behind him bogeys the hole. So now Chi-Chi's got a 2-shot lead over Palmer going into the 18th hole. And Chi-Chi pars the 18th hole. So now Palmer's going to need to hole out on the 18th hole. He would need an eagle on the par 4 18th hole to tie. The interesting thing here is this is not just any 18th hole. This is the Tam O'Shanter Golf Course. And this is where the first nationally televised tournament had ever been played 11 years before. And there was a very famous shot taken in that tournament. Lou Worsham holed out on that 18th hole for eagle to win the tournament from 104 yards out. Now, Palmer's ball was about 25 yards away from the plaque where Lou Worsham had holed out. And Arnie hits, and his ball lands and stops 18 feet from the cup. And when the ball didn't go in, Chi-Chi had defeated the king and won the Western Open. And sports columnists around the country did their best to celebrate this win. It was so fun reading a lot of these newspaper articles about Chi-Chi. My favorite one was the great columnist Jim Murray, who always liked to provide a little humor in his sports column. I just want to read a little excerpt. He said, Chi-Chi Rodriguez plays golf as if it were a New Year's Eve party. When he holes a putt, he does a little South American dance. His name, they suggest, should be Cha-Cha Rodriguez. And he goes on from there.
I think we all remember Les Nessman, right? Chi-Chi Rodriguez, the great news anchor from WKRP. That's one of my favorites. One more before I let you go, Len. We've talked an awful lot tonight about 1974, and you once found an error in reporting by the New York Times regarding a round that Johnny Miller shot that year, and it was a pretty big error, right?
Yeah, so 1974, that was Johnny Miller's big year. We were talking about this earlier. That's when he got off to that incredible start. He won the first 3 tournaments, and he won a total of 8 times. Even Jack Nicklaus never won 8 tournaments in a season, and it took until 1999, until Tiger Woods did it, until it was done again. So Johnny Miller had just an awesome year in 1974. And he was firing some really low rounds. I think in one of those first 3 tournaments, he shot a 62. And this is back when we didn't see a lot of 62s back in the early 1970s. So there was some talk about, could Miller shoot a 59? And before the Masters, Miller was actually interviewed about what did he think was the possibility of shooting a 59. And, you know, he said, you know, if we played the short courses of the 1950s, back in the 50s, they played courses that were like 6,200 yards, 6,400 yards. So he said, if we would have played the short courses from the 1960s, you know, I could have shot a 59. So, but the fact of the matter is, nobody would have been so surprised in 1974, if Miller would have had one round of sensational putting and got his 59. And so that's kind of the lead in here. So I was following Nicklaus's 74 season. One of the tournaments, a couple of weeks after the Masters, was the Tournament of Champions. So this is kind of like the tournament we have now at the start of the season, but they did it at the end of April. It was, and at that time, it was literally only open to players that had won a PGA Tour event in the year, in the 52 weeks prior. So it was a limited, a small field, and but a really good field. And Miller goes out and shoots a 75 in the first round, and he's thinking he's just completely out of the tournament. But then he pulls himself together, and it goes right down to the last hole, and he wins the tournament. He wins one of his eight that he won in 1974. The next day in the New York Times, they have the composite four-round scores of all the players. And my eyes kind of pop off the page because I see he had a 59 in the second round. Now, after about 1 second, I realized that's got to be a mistake because I know for a fact that Al Geiberger shot a 59 in 1977. I think it was the Danny Thomas Classic. And
yep.
We called him Mr. 59 for years after that. I think it was another 15 years till anybody shot a 59. So for a long time, he was Mr. 59 all by himself. So I knew that, but I still investigated a little further. And sure enough, Johnny Miller had shot a 69. It was widely reported everywhere. You know, in the second round of the Tournament of Champions, he shot a 69, not a 59. And so this was clearly a typo. But it occurred to me with the advent of AI that even though this is a typo, let's project ourselves like 100 years from now. And imagine in 100 years from now, people have gotten lazy because any kind of factual thing, we don't have to go to historians. People don't have to remember these things. We don't have to go to books. We can just ask AI, who shot the first 59? And AI, 100 years from now, is probably going to use the most trusted news sources. And one, I don't want to get it political, but one of the most trusted news sources would be the New York Times. And if AI would look back and see this 59 in one of the most trusted news sources, it might spit back an answer that the first 59 was shot by Johnny Miller in 1974 at the Tournament of Champions. So I decided I need to contact the New York Times and have them make a correction for the protection of the future history of golf. So I write to the New York Times, and this was actually to the day 50 years after. So on April 29, 2024, I was reading the April 29, 1974 New York Times. I uncover this typo, and I write to the New York Times at 9 in the morning. 3 hours later, just after
Wow, that's quick.
The New York Times writes back to me, and they basically tell me, well, in so many words, they tell me, and in my book, I put the actual email, you know, thank you for uncovering this mistake we made, but we can't correct it. We have to spend our resources, our time and resources reporting today's news. We can't go back. We recognize we have mistakes in the past. We can't go back and correct every one of them. And then I sent a rebuttal. I said, you know, this was not just any mistake, you know, and I pointed out again, and I said, can't you at least put something, you know, put an overlay or something. You don't have to actually try to change the newspaper archive, but just put something there that says, this is a mistake. It should be 69. I never got another response from them. So it's still out there. And so so I wrote an article about it. I titled it, at the time I wrote an article, that article is now my book. I titled it, Johnny Miller Shoots a 59, or did he? And it's all about this trying to, you know, the mistake and trying to protect the future history of golf. And it's kind of interesting now because if you Google, did Johnny Miller shoot a 59 in 1974, or did Johnny Miller ever shoot a 59? AI will tell you, no, he didn't, but there was a mistake in the New York Times.
Ah.
And the Sports Time Traveler has reported on it.
Nice. That's awesome. Len, before I let you go, remind our listeners again how they can get copies of your books, plus follow you on Substack and social media as well.
The easiest way is to go to my website, which is very simply thesportstimetraveler.com. If you forget the, you can just go to sportstimetraveler.com. That'll get you to the same place. And at my website, I have links to to my books that are available on Amazon and other online booksellers, and also my Substack newsletter, where I've written over 400 articles covering all sports, but I have my real passion is golf. I've written quite a bit of golf stories, and I will continue to write quite a bit of golf stories. And I've collected my favorite golf stories to go into my book. So my book's called Great Golf Tournaments, again, available on Amazon. And it's Great Golf Tournaments Volume 1, because I fully intend to write a Volume 2 and a Volume 3. I already have the cover pictures for Volume 2 and Volume 3. And what I do in the book is there's 30 chapters. Each chapter tells the story of a historic golf tournament that took place between 50 and 100 years ago. So you've got the 1974 Los Angeles Open and the 1950 Los Angeles Open and some of the majors, the 1975 Masters, which I think was the greatest golf tournament ever played. And even really long ago tournaments that I knew nothing about, and it was absolutely fascinating to do the research, the 1921 British Open, which was an absolutely fascinating tournament. So it's called Great Golf Tournaments, available on Amazon. And I would love to hear, I have not picked the tournaments that I'm going to follow for Volume 2 of the book, but I'd love to hear input from any listeners about what tournaments they would like me to follow.
Len, how can they also listen to your show?
Well, you can get to the podcast through my website. So go to my website. It's the simplest way to find me and reach all of my media. So again, thesportstimetraveler.com has access to my newsletter, podcast, and my books. And also my live shows. I do live shows as well. I've been a regular at the Villages, which is the largest retirement community in the country. I'll be back at the Villages on December 9th.
Well, Len, it has been a lot of fun having you as part of this show. I hope you'll come back and keep us updated on the great things you're doing, which course or which tournaments you end up choosing for Volume 2, and then sharing more of that with us. You're fantastic, my friend.
Thank you so much, Chris. It was really great to be here.
Take care, Len. All the best to you and your family. We'll catch up soon. Folks, that is, again, a wonderful guy, Len Furman. I mean, how much fun was that? And I love the idea that he is going back and looking at all of these, not only just the old tournaments, but going back through the old newspapers and doing it day at a time, right? So he's not getting ahead of himself. He's seeing what it was like to be in the moment during those things and the emotions that are, you know, can get brought up and feel what it's like to, you know, rooting for your guy or whatever it is. I mean, that's fantastic stuff. And then on top of that, I mean, look, you want to talk about a guy that brings enthusiasm to the show. That's one of the things, you know, when he and I were communicating prior to the show, he was very enthusiastic about the things that he wanted to talk about and the things that he's working on and the book and all of that. And then it comes through in his voice as he's retelling the stories. You can't ask for a better guest than that. So I'm excited to have Len back on the show. Like I say, hopefully we get a little insight, maybe a peek under the tent for what Volume 2 is, and reach out to him if you've got some ones that you want him to, you know, to retell those stories. I know from my perspective, again, being a huge Nicklaus fan, not only that 75 Masters, which I agree with him is the greatest golf tournament ever, but as you get into the 1980 U.S. Open and the PGA Championship, I think those were a couple other great tournaments that Jack won. And then, of course, the 86 Masters, that's great. That's, you know, if 75 is the greatest tournament for how it played out in the back and the forth between, you know, Jack and Johnny Miller and Tom Weisskopf, well, 86 is a great story in and of itself for a guy that got written off. So hopefully we get Len back on the show again soon. All right, my friends, it is time for me to put a bow on this edition of Next on the Tee. My sincere thanks again to my great friend Tucker Booth and the wonderful Len Furman for joining me on this show. Coming up on the next edition of the show, and I've said this a couple of times, but I've been so blessed with so many wonderful friends wanting to jump in, haven't got to this episode yet, but PGA Master Professional John Hughes, another wonderful friend of the show, he'll be back. My Goomba Rob Strano, he'll be here, and one of the all-time great sports talk radio hosts and a wonderful friend over on our football show Thursday Night Tailgate, guy who's in our guest Hall of Fame, Zig Fracassi, will join me. I want to thank our friends, as I always do here at the end of the show, over at the Pittsburgh Tribune Review for hosting this show on their site. For coverage of everything going on in Western Pennsylvania, including your favorite sports, go to triblive.com. You can find this show by then clicking on the sports section tab. And the most recent episode of the show is going to be front and center for you there on the homepage of the sports section. Or you can click on sports and then podcast network. Then you're going to see the Next on the Tee logo. If you click on that, many of the most recent episodes from this season are right there for you as well. You can also find this show over on Good Pods, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, and GolfNewsNet.com. Pretty much anywhere you get your podcast content, Next on the Tee is going to be available for you there as well. Folks, my biggest thanks, as always, go out to each and every one of you for pressing play and making Next on the Tee a part of your regular golf content. I can't thank you all enough. Until next time, hit 'em straight, my friends.
Thanks for joining Chris again this week on Next on the Tee. We hope you enjoyed the conversations as much as we did. Please share the show with your golf buddies and be sure to follow it on Trib Live or your favorite podcast app so you never miss an episode. Thanks for pressing play and being part of the journey. We'll see you next week, right here, where the best minds in golf share their stories.
When you think about businesses that are selling through the roof, Allbirds or Skims, sure, you think about a great product, a cool brand, and brilliant marketing. But an often overlooked secret is actually the businesses behind the business, making selling, and for the shoppers buying, simple. For millions of businesses, that business is Shopify. Nobody does selling better than Shopify, home of the number one checkout on the planet. And the not-so-secret secret, with Shop Pay, that boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning way less carts going abandoned and way more sales going... So if you're into growing your business, your commerce platform better be ready to sell wherever your customers are scrolling or strolling on the web, in your store, in their feed, and everywhere in between. Businesses that sell more sell on Shopify. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout Skims uses. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/audioboom, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/audioboom to upgrade your selling today. Shopify.com/audioboom.